This is The Takeaway for Friday, June 16, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. Thank you so much for listening. And there's news this week that the special counsel investigation into the campaign of President Donald Trump and possible ties to Russia is broadening. Now it appears that special counsel Robert Mueller is looking at the president himself and whether he tried to obstruct justice when he asked former FBI Director James Comey to drop an investigation and then later fired him. There's also the question of whether the president asked members of his team, including the heads of intelligence agencies, to try and get the FBI to stand down on their investigation. Now, behind all this news and swirling accusations, though, is Robert Mueller and the investigation itself. And Bob Mueller has been very busy assembling a team of lawyers and investigators. They include experts in criminal law, financial crimes, and appellate law, and they'll be the ones responsible for the interviews and the investigation, looking at whether there was coordination with Russia or collusion, and now potentially even obstruction of justice. President Trump lashed out on Thursday morning, saying that Robert Mueller and his team represented the single greatest witch hunt in American political history, led by some very bad and conflicted people. And here was former Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich, a Trump ally and a surrogate, talking to George Stephanopoulos on ABC's Good Morning America this week.
These are bad people.
Bad people?
Bad people. I mean, these are people who are going to be after Trump.
I had Ken Starr.
He did not hire a single Republican in the first wave.
I had Ken Starr, the former independent counsel, on the show yesterday. He said this is a fantastic team of complete professionals.
Well, Ken Starr and I live in two different universes then.
In Newt Gingrich's universe, Robert Mueller's team is filled with bad people. We should point out that it was 1 month ago tomorrow that the former Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich, said on Twitter that Robert Mueller is a superb choice to be special counsel and that his reputation is impeccable for honesty and integrity. And that leads to the question of whether Donald Trump and his allies, including Newt Gingrich, think that with Robert Mueller and his team, there really is something to worry about. David Latt is an attorney and founder and managing editor of the legal website Above the Law, and he joins me now in studio. David Latt, welcome.
Thanks, Todd.
The team that Robert Mueller has assembled here. Now, Newt Gingrich has his view out in the media that these are bad people. These are people with long careers and a lot of varied skills. Let's assess the team broadly before we get specific. What kind of team is this?
This is a spectacular team of legal talent, an amazing assemblage of lawyers with distinguished careers in public service and private practice. These are people with tremendous sterling reputations for ethical conduct, glittering resumes. It would be hard to find a team of more well-credentialed and highly regarded lawyers than this one.
Well, let's go through the roster a little bit, and it's fairly lengthy, but there are some standout names. James Quarles III is a former assistant special prosecutor. He was involved in Watergate, so he's got a pedigree that goes back to the previous chapter that's on a lot of people's minds now.
Yes. So I think Quarles brings a deep, deep knowledge of these types of investigations into presidential administrations. So because of his experience on the Watergate team, he has the ability to investigate both criminal conduct and the political chops and the ability to navigate very sensitive territory. He is a former senior partner at WilmerHale, which is the law firm that special counsel Bob Mueller came from. So he has a history of working with the special counsel, and he is a very well-regarded attorney.
Michael Dreeben is another recent hire by Robert Mueller. He's a criminal law expert and considered, I've read by most people, to be one of the top criminal appellate attorneys in the country. What does that choice say to you?
So I would say Michael Dreeben is the top criminal appellate lawyer in the country, especially on the government side. He has argued more than 100 cases before the United States Supreme Court. He has served in the Solicitor General's office, which represents the administration before the High Court across multiple administrations. He is one of the finest legal minds out there. Now, it's interesting to note, he is an appellate specialist. He's a Supreme Court specialist. In other words, he's not a trial lawyer. He's not a street fighter. He's a strategist. So having him on board, I think, suggests two things. One, this team is very conscious of the big picture, not just the battle, but the entire war. And second, I think what Dreeben shows is they're looking at possible legal issues down the road. Say you get some convictions for obstruction of justice or money laundering or what have you. Those convictions get to be appealed. Michael Dreeben is an appellate lawyer. He's an expert in making sure those convictions stick as opposed to get overturned. Dreeben is a hire for the long game.
Now, David Latt, you just mentioned there financial crimes. And Andrew Weissman has also been brought on. He's a former organized crime prosecutor, but he's also an expert on financial crimes. And we already know that Robert Mueller is looking into business dealings of Michael Flynn and Paul Manafort and possibly others. So what does this tell us?
So Andrew Weissman is a foremost prosecutor of white-collar crime. He used to head the Justice Department's fraud section, and he made his bones on the Enron case, which was one of the hugest financial scandals in American business history. So again, if what he brings to the table is a deep, deep insight into financial and white-collar crime, and if they are going to be looking at activities with Manafort and Flynn, possible money laundering, money moving across borders, he's the guy.
Who's Lisa Page?
Lisa Page is also a lawyer with Justice Department experience. She's actually still at the department. And she also has a great deal of experience with money laundering cases, specifically in the international area and specifically out of the former Eastern Bloc. So in many ways, her expertise is complementary to Andrew Weissman's, and she's also an invaluable asset to this group.
And then there's Aaron Zebley, who I've read was a counterterrorism agent, essentially, traveling to Africa busting terrorists. And I thought, impressive career, but what's he doing here with Mueller?
So Aaron Zebley, I think, is probably the member of this team with the best war stories. He's kind of like international man of mystery. He worked as an FBI agent for 7 years on anti-terrorism stuff, but he also has legal chops. He's a graduate of UVA Law School, which is where Bob Mueller also went. He was a partner at WilmerHale, which is the firm that Bob Mueller came from. And he has a very deep ability to get to the bottom of things, whether it is catching international terrorists like the people who conducted the Tanzania and Kenya embassy bombings, or whether it is handling cases on behalf of large corporations like the ones that retain WilmerHale.
There are criticisms of this team that we've been talking about, which are worth consideration. Many of them have given political donations to Democratic candidates. Republicans point to that to say this is a biased investigative team. What do you think of that accusation? Is it important?
I don't make much of that accusation. These are people of incredible integrity. And the head of this investigation is Bob Mueller, who has served as both a Republican and Democratic appointee. He served in the Bush 1 administration. He served in the Bush 2 administration. And he's running the show. So even if people below him have made political contributions to a Democratic candidate here or there, I would not put much weight on that. Furthermore, some of them have given to both sides. Quarles has given to both Democrats and Republicans. And some of the other members of the team have no giving history whatsoever. So I think that criticism doesn't really carry much water.
David Latt, attorney, founding and managing editor of the legal website Above the Law. Thanks for coming in.
Hey, thanks for having me, Todd.
Well, the investigations continue in Washington, but meanwhile, the business of the presidency goes on. And in Miami today, President Trump outlines his vision to crack down on U.S. travel and trade with Cuba. It's a campaign promise from the president and a potential reversing of the thawing relations established under President Obama as early as 2014. The White House now is moving to restrict tourism money flowing into Cuba. The administration says some of that money is going to oppressive elements of the regime, including military intelligence and security services. Now, according to the Pew Research Center, 75% of Americans support the opening of relations between Cuba and the United States. But is President Trump's crackdown really all that drastic? Christopher Sabatini is a lecturer at Columbia University and the executive director of the research nonprofit Global Americans. Welcome to the studio, Christopher.
Thanks, Todd.
This new policy from President Trump, rolling back some of the openings to Cuba, as we said, what specifically is the president doing here?
Well, first of all, it's not as big or as large as he is intended. It promised even in the campaign. He had really sort of trashed Obama's policy as being a bad deal. What he's doing is he's going to limit travel that benefits the military. This is what he said several times, what was said in a White House briefing on Thursday afternoon. The idea being that the military controls much of the tourism or hospitality industry in Cuba. So there's going to be greater effort to license restricted travel to the island, clamped down on what exists now are sort of 12 categories of tourism that allow U.S. citizens to travel to Cuba and self-declare that they're going there for cultural purposes, but without any sort of guided tours. What he's going to do is sort of require that U.S. citizens to go there, do it under an organized tour group, and that they not stay in military-owned hotels or hospitality institutions.
So that affects individual travel, and does that mean also that American businesses that are doing business with Cuban businesses have to try to certify or declare that that money is also not going to the military?
It's not entirely clear how this will play out in sort of bureaucratic terms or licensing terms. And there's a problem there too. Of course, we know this is a government that is really struggling to staff up and really get in the weeds of policy. But so we aren't really sure. But clearly, there will be greater attention to the reasons for travel and even sort of audits of why people go and to make sure that money spent on the island is not going into the coffers of the military.
What about the bigger issues, the trade embargo, the famous wet foot, dry foot policy that allows Cubans who wind up on U.S. soil to gain immigration access? Are any of those things changing?
Well, first of all, the embargo is law. Thanks to a 1992 law and then 1996-97 law, Helms-Burton, that never changed even under Obama. But there were some allowances for greater trade, for increased U.S. citizens could bring in an unlimited amount of cigars or rum, which allowed them to be able to engage in trade. There were some opportunities with in the pharmaceutical industry. I think those will close down because a lot of those are state or even military-owned. The military owns about two-thirds of the industry in Cuba, so those are going to be shut down. In addition, though, the wet foot, dry foot, the policy that allowed Cubans to arrive as soon as they arrived in the United States to apply for citizenship and to gain residency for the first year, that's not going to be changed. That is still in place. They've made that very clear. It was actually even unpopular among a number of Cuban Americans before.
So what's at play here, Christopher Sabatini, when we step back from the individual pieces of policy here? Staying tough on Cuba is definitely popular among a segment of Republicans. That's understandable. Donald Trump would want to give them something politically that they like. But is there a broader strategy beyond that about what the president is doing here?
Well, first of all, it's not all that popular to begin with. It is a small sliver, as you say, Todd. Basically, about 60 to 65% of Cuban Americans are in favor of lifting the embargo. But for some hardliners like Marco Rubio, the senator of Florida, and Mario Diaz-Balart, the congressman from southern Florida, this is really their baby. This is one of the primary demands, and they've been bragging for a long time that they've been driving this policy. But the truth is that the Obama-era policies were very popular, even within the broader American electorate. 75% of Americans support the Obama policies. So what's driving this is really just a sense of revenge. I think part of it is also just the desire for Trump to sort of strike a better deal, to announce another executive order, to be able to show that he's keeping his promises in the campaign. That's really what's driving a lot of this.
Is there a broader American commentary on authoritarianism or democracy here? I mean, we have the president in Florida doing a traditional American thing, which is decrying authoritarianism in Cuba. But we also have a president who has had praise for Recep Erdogan in Turkey, for Duterte in the Philippines, even for Vladimir Putin himself. That there's a disconnect there.
Surely. There's a number of disconnects here. The first one is the one you say, Todd, is that he's going to announce the importance of human rights and democracy, and this is done in those – but you know, Cuba is a country of 11 million people. It's a case where he can argue for democracy with very little cost. I mean, Cuba doesn't matter in the grand geostrategic scheme of things. But at the same time, this is a president who said he's going to roll back regulations and lift the state back from off the backs of U.S. citizens, and actually he's reimposing it by imposing all of these licensing restrictions on U.S. travelers.
Christopher Sabatini, lecturer at Columbia University and executive director of Global Americans. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Todd.
Richard T. Split. Don't know why I said T. My middle name's John.
Welcome back. It's Todd Zwillick. And if you watch HBO's hit comedy Veep, it's probably because you love spending time with its clutch of depraved, jaded, and mostly incompetent Washington, D.C. insiders whose main job seems to be thinking of the most vulgar and hilarious ways to insult each other. But in the Veep version of cynical Washington, Richard Splett stands out. He's semi-competent, but he's also loyal and, above all, weirdly positive and earnest.
The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled in Crowley v. Nevada that you don't have to recount the paper audit trails in local elections.
That's Crowley versus Nevada.
That's Crowley? Actually, you know what? I could email you. Or, you know, you could email me at splet2@splettnet.net. Splat one's my father. I mean, I'll be sad to see him go, but it'll be nice to get my hands on that handle, you know?
You're listening there to actor Sam Richardson. He plays Richard Splett on Veep, and Sam's Pollyannish expressions and impeccable timing have helped make Richard a fan favorite. Now, a lot of people, including this host and Washington resident, consider Splett the funniest standout on a show full of hilarious characters. Sam is also the co-creator and co-star of a new sitcom that aired earlier this year called Detroiters on Comedy Central. It just got picked up for a second season, but I was most excited to talk to Sam about his work on Veep.
DC people especially are the ones who I think love the show the most. Often they say that our depiction of DC in politics is the most accurate one, which I don't know if it's settling. It's unsettling, I think, is the word.
You know, Richard Splett's guilelessness is one of my favorite things about the show. And I can't pass up this opportunity because there is a bit of dialogue from your performance on Veep that is so famous amongst my friends, both in politics and in journalism. So I got to play it.
Senator Wilkie has been begging to see me, and lots of other people want meetings, too. VP Doyle's a lame duck. You know what you do with lame animals?
Care for them.
You shoot them dead.
Oh, no. Yeah, I gotcha. Kinder in the long run, actually.
I mean, there is quintessential Splett. You got a wounded animal? Care for him.
Just that goes, I think, to the core of what Richard's belief is.
You know, in another era of television, there might have been an entire family of Splets. I mean, the Dick Van Dyke Show could have been the Splets, and somebody who was cynical and mean would have been the comic foil. They would have been the one to stand out. And maybe it's just a testament to modern television that this is 180 degrees opposite.
Yeah, that's true. You know, the world, I think, kind of exists in cynicism now, which is not great. But I think a character like Richard being opposite for that, like, really just helps comedically. The idea of a person being positive is funny, which is interesting.
Meanwhile, politics continues to develop in this strange and surreal world that we're in the real world. I mean, were you as scared as a lot of other people associated with the show that Veep might not be funny anymore?
Yeah.
As political satire?
Because like, if you're, like, painting... it's an analogy out of nowhere. If you're painting a picture, a portrait of somebody, and then they dip their face in oil, what are you painting anymore? Now you're just kind of doing it off the memory of it. But hopefully everybody remembers what real politics was like, because now there's no rules. Like, what's going on? Like, it's.
But has the show changed in the Trump era in terms of how the actors handle it or how the writers are putting the show together?
No. It has not. In some specific jokes that were written had to be, like, changed because, like, it became reality. Like, there was a pee-pee joke that had to be changed because it's like, oh, you guys are doing a Trump joke. It's like, no, we thought of something that would be ridiculous that would never be brought up for a political figure or a president. And then it happened, or then, like, it was alluded to. So then it was like, well, we got to change this. So there's so many things. And usually it happens to, like, the order is different. Like, we'll do something on the show, and then maybe a few months later, it happens in real life. And we're like, oh, well, how could we have known? This one just kind of all of it front loaded. So we're like, well, we can't do that. Can't do that. We wrapped the show in, like, February. So, like, a lot of the things that are happening now that are kind of like in the parallel in the real lifetime timeline are so incredibly coincidental. It's a little mind boggling.
Coincidental or predictive?
Predictive.
I mean, that's the disturbing thing about it.
The oracle.
The orb.
The orb. Like, you see, exactly. Like, if you had written that Selena Meyer goes and, like, she stands on a magical, mystical orb, you'd have been like, well, no, guys, come on. Let's be creative. Let's not go into comic book land. Let's do something that would happen in reality. And I still – what is that orb? Do you know?
Yeah, I think it was the opening to a big Saudi anti-terrorism facility, and that they were lighting it up for the first time.
That was the on switch.
That was the on switch.
Oh, okay.
The orb.
Obviously, a switch, I think, would do it.
Right, a regular switch might have done it.
Switch or a button, you know. But I don't know. Maybe that's just years ahead in technology. Like, all things are orb powered.
Well, I want to talk about your new show, too, because this is not just an acting gig, Detroiters, but a creation of of yours on Comedy Central just finished its first season. Let's listen to a clip.
I'm Mike Tussle, the tough lawyer. I'll fight for you and I'll win. I read all these books.
It's one of our best commercials.
I'm honestly proud.
It's so good.
Who makes that crap?
I'm Mike Tussle.
I know!
They suck. I hope they die.
It sucks like from beginning to end.
We should find him and kill him.
Yeah, well...
Sam Richardson, you and your partner on this show are kind of Bush League ad men trying to make commercials in Detroit and kind of on the hustle.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And it's two local ad men trying to make commercials in the city of Detroit, which they love more than anything. Just like me in real life and my friend Tim in real life, we love Detroit above all places. So like you're talking about, it's another comedy where it's like anti-cynicism. You know, really the basis of it is love these guys have for each other and where they're from.
You know, I don't want to get too sentimental with it, but Detroit is a city that's had a lot of setbacks and is fighting on its way back. We all know that. Is there an element of the fight back in Detroit here?
There is. In the characters, in the people, I think we tried to show a little bit of that indomitable spirit of Detroiters. And also to not show that same kind of what we used to term ruin porn that is the typical portrayal of Detroit. We wanted to have a fun comedy that's not about the blight of the city, but just about the people and about the place and its positives and its negatives. And I don't think there's been a show that has done that.
Detroiters is the newish show on Comedy Central. Sam Richardson is the star and one of the creators of that show. And Sam is a denizen and an animal of Washington, D.C. I just got to say again, man, you're making some of the best satire. You're making some of the best stuff on Veep that any of us have ever seen. It's religious. We love it.
Oh, thank you. And when I come there, protect me.
Sam Richardson plays Richard Splett on Veep. On HBO. Sam, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you, Todd.
Really did it. You maniac! You blow it up!
This is stone blowing up. A whopper!
Mr. will toss it before it reaches the core. You have to anchor it.
Money's safe. We're not. The water rose a foot in the last 20 minutes.
Fog is getting thicker.
And Leon's getting larger.
Friday is movie day here on The Takeaway, and our resident film critic is Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday and for us, and he's here in studio. Hi, Rafer.
Hey, Todd.
Great to have you back. We have just one movie on tap this week, and there are a lot of summer movies coming out, but we're going to focus on All Eyes on Me, the new biopic about the life and music and activism of Tupac Shakur, right?
Yes, that's right.
Now, we're about to get to that. I have a little bit of Tupac trivia. I love to do trivia with you. Now, if you know the answer, save it. We're going to come back to it at the end of the segment. And if you know the answer to this and you're listening right now, do hit me at Todd Zwillick on Twitter because you might get a shout out if you know this little blast from back in 1993. Tupac Shakur starred in a movie called Poetic Justice, directed by John Singleton. Who was his co-star? That's your question. Rayford's nodding. He thinks he knows it. Often he doesn't. If you know it, hit me on Twitter. Now let's talk about Tupac and the latest movie all about him, All Eyes on Me. This is directed by Benny Boom. Before we get started, let's hear a clip.
Like all black leaders, you have a bullseye on your back, and today it just got bigger.
But I ain't no black leader. Not yet.
And how you not a black leader? The vice president was just talking about you on the TV. Baby, you have to understand. With the Panthers, it wasn't that we had guns or black leather. It was because of our message. We were transforming minds. They are gonna come after you with everything you love.
Now, Rafer, this is the type of conversation that's not one that we're used to hearing about the famous gangster rapper Tupac Shakur.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that was the whole thing about Tupac Shakur. I think he was such a complicated and kind of maddening figure at the time. I mean, he was one of the stars of gangster rap. You remember Dan Quayle went after him. On the one hand, here was a guy who looked like, you know, white America's idea of a gangster, the thug life tattoo, the low slung pants, the kerchief on the head.
Holding 9mm for promo photos.
Exactly, right. On the other hand, he was so eloquent on record, and his lyrics were so insightful, and he was such a magnetic interview subject. I don't know if you remember his interviews on MTV at the time, but he could speak so eloquently about black life in America. It was very hard to get a handle on him. And what we just heard there was his mother, Afeni Shakur, played by Danai Gurira, who was a Black Panther, trying to kind of school him and enlighten him and tell him he had a responsibility to deliver a strong message. That's a lot to wrap, you know, your hands around as a movie. And I just think this movie is not up to the task. I think it really oversimplifies Shakur. I think it's very jumbled. I think it's got a script that just doesn't know quite how to dramatize a scene and kind of get you into the mind and the heart of this really complicated character.
It can be a challenge also in cases like this to mix the music of the artist with the activism and the broader story that they're trying to portray.
Right. I mean, something like Straight Outta Compton did that very well. And I just don't feel that this movie, even though it's directed by Benny Boom, who was a music video director, I just don't think this movie has the ability to do that.
I was a huge Tupac fan when I was a younger man. I remain one to this day, so I'll probably see this, even okay. if it falls short, because the music, I just want to see this performance and the depiction. Now, let's get back to trivia before we go. Rafer, I asked you about 1993, when a young Tupac Shakur starred in Poetic Justice, directed by John Singleton. Who was his co-star?
Janet Jackson.
Janet Jackson is right. Miss Jackson, if you're nasty, and Ramen Noodles Esquire on Twitter knew the answer to that. So congratulations, Rafer. Thanks for joining us. Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday and for us here at The Takeaway.
Thanks, Todd.
Classical pianist descended on Fort Worth, Texas over the last few weeks. Once every 4 years, the Van Cliburn Piano Competition is on. And for the 15th Van Cliburn this year, 300 hopeful musicians were whittled down to just 30 competitors who played solo works and concertos for a marathon 2.5 weeks. On Saturday, Yekwon Sun-woo of South Korea took home the gold. Two Americans placed second and third. They were Kenneth Broberg of Minneapolis and Daniel Hsu of San Francisco. Tonight, the winners make their first public performances since the competition in the green space here at WNYC Studios in New York. Now, there's a long and prestigious history, though, behind the music here.
It was in 1958 that Van Cliburn, for whom this competition's named, won the first Tchaikovsky in Moscow. And then 4 years later, a doctor named Earl Allison, a music professor, says, I want to name a contest in honor of Rildia B's son, Van. And Rildia was Van's first teacher. So this competition, the Cliburn, launched in 1962.
Bill Zeeble is a reporter with KERA in Dallas, and he traveled all the way from auditions in Moscow to the finale in Fort Worth, Texas, to cover the competition. He says the Van Cliburn is different from other prestigious piano competitions.
What happens with this one, you get concert management and concert bookings for 3 solid years. So the gold medalist gets international concerts for the next 3 years. That's a career builder. You can build a life out of that if you continue to play well. People will invite you back.
Now, let's talk a little bit about this year's top finishers, because you've been covering them. Lucky for us, we have the chance to hear each of these competitors play. Let's start with Daniel Hsu from San Francisco. Bill Zeeble, what are we hearing here from Daniel Hsu that makes him one of the top pianists in the world?
We're listening to the end of Modest Mussorgsky's Pictures at an Exhibition, and it is a grand and majestic piano piece, which, if you don't have a grasp of the whole thing, can sound like a bunch of little pieces that don't quite make sense. The challenge in this work is to pull it all together with many ups and downs and grand sounds and small sounds. And Daniel Hsu has this just gorgeous piano sound and a real musical command.
All right, let's hear next from Kenneth Broberg, 23, from Minneapolis, who finished second.
That that's one of the variations on Rachmaninoff's Rhapsody on a theme of Paganini, which is a pretty famous piece. The challenge in that is, one, to make sure you get all the variations right, and to work with an orchestra. And we heard some concerto performances where that just didn't happen. So Kenneth Broberg pulled this off in a really satisfying way and comes off looking really good by comparison to some of the other six concerto players. And of course, by the time you get to be a concerto performer in this contest, you've played 2.5 hours of recital and you've played a quintet. So this is like the culmination and the end of the marathon. And he played it with energy.
And Yekwon Sun-woo of South Korea, this year's winner. Let's hear from Sun-woo. What made Yekwon Sun-woo stand out here?
Well, it wasn't just that he could tackle one of Schubert's last sonatas and play it in a musical way. It's one of the big pieces of the piano world and not often played. But he also played with the chamber group, and he played a Mozart piano concerto, which leaves you bare. If you make a mistake, it's obvious. And he tackled those with a gorgeous sound, a really mature voice. It's still growing, and he's still evolving. But there's a lot there already, and that's what stood out for the judges.
From Dallas, Fort Worth to Moscow and back, Bill Zeibel has been covering the Van Cliburn International Piano Competition for KERA in Dallas. Bill Zeibel, thank you so much for taking us through this year's performances.
My pleasure.
Tickets for tonight's event in the Green Space in New York are sold out, but you can hear the concert and see the webcast streaming live at 7 p.m. Eastern by visiting WQXR.org. Welcome back. It's Todd Zwillick, and that's what it sounded like outside the Turkish ambassador's residence in Washington, D.C. last month. Bodyguards for Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan attacked protesters who were gathered there, injuring at least 11 people. Now, nearly a month later, D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser and Police Chief Peter Newsom announced charges against those suspects.
We had two arrests on the day of the incident. We have two U.S. citizens who were arrested yesterday morning. We have two Canadian citizens and 12 Turkish citizens. So the total number is 18. We currently have 14 outstanding warrants.
Now, 12 of those outstanding warrants are Turkish citizens who belong to Erdogan's security team, and they face arrest if they return to the United States. Meanwhile, the Turkish Foreign Ministry issued an angry reaction, calling the charges unacceptable and wrong, biased, and lacking in legal basis. Diane Nissenbaum is a national security reporter for The Wall Street Journal who spent time in Turkey.
From the video that we were able to see and from the cell phone video, there was an anti-Erdogan demonstration that marched to the Turkish ambassador's residence and gathered in a small park out there. And there were some Erdogan supporters who were also there that were sort of being kept apart by police and some secret service. And as President Erdogan looked on, the emotions got higher. The anti-Erdogan supporters had flags of the Kurdish separatist groups that are opposed to Erdogan's crackdown on the Kurds and are seeking autonomy. And the emotions got heated, and what we saw was members of President Erdogan's security team beating, kicking demonstrators in the park, beating them bloody, kicking them as the police tried to separate them. It went on for some time. It was quite brutal. 9 people were sent to the hospital. 1 police officer was injured. 2 Secret Service members were injured. It was what the police chief called an unexpected clash, and it sent shockwaves through Washington.
It really was remarkable. Members of Erdogan's security team literally running down a hill into the melee and throwing punches.
Yeah, one of the most interesting videos that people focused on was President Erdogan in his car at the residence, sitting in his car, and one of the members of his security team leaning in and kind of telling him what was happening. And you see him talk to another member of the security team who then heads down the hill, and you see President Erdogan get out of the car and kind of watch what's happening. And you can't exactly see what's the trigger there, but soon after the member of the security team goes down the hill, you see the melee erupt on the other side, and you see President Erdogan watching it impassively and then turning and going into the residence. And it triggered some speculation that perhaps President Erdogan had ordered this, but the police chief was saying that there's no evidence at this point to suggest that he'd done so.
It was a remarkable scene in almost every way, Dion Nissenbaum, but there seemed to be a muted response at first from the Trump administration. Now we have these warrants out for several of Erdogan's agents, for a dozen of them. What do we make of that?
Well, there was a muted response at first. People may remember that when President Erdogan came to D.C. last time, there was a bit of a clash outside a think tank in Washington between some of his security team and some journalists. And so maybe they thought that they had free hand to be a little more aggressive this time around. But the response, especially from members of Congress from both parties, was quite strong, pushing for a response. The House of Representatives passed a unanimous resolution calling for a crackdown, and I think the images were so shocking that the administration felt like they had to take some response. And so they worked with the police department. I think the fact that Secret Service agents were also injured probably was a factor in this. And now they've issued these arrest warrants. 7 of the 12 members of Erdogan's security team are facing felony assault charges if they ever return to the U.S. And the police chief made it clear that if they return, they would be arrested. I think the most likely outcome here is that these guards will never return to the U.S. They won't be granted visas to come back and be part of the security detail, even if Turkey requests that they come back. The other impact I think that we could possibly see is there's a pending request with the administration from Turkey for a $1.2 million deal to give the Turkish security handguns and ammunition. And there's been some calls in Congress for that to be rejected. You may see that be one of the outcomes here. I don't think you'll see these guys return to face charges in court. Doesn't seem like it's going to be in the cards.
What about the overall relationship between the United States and Turkey? We've seen a president who praises Recep Erdogan, even at controversial times. We've seen tension behind the scenes with American supportive Kurdish groups that obviously Turkey very much disapproves of. Does this incident play into a broader story about the relationship?
It certainly does. I think that President Erdogan likes to use these kinds of things as pressure points with the U.S. to try and get something out of the Trump administration. In the grand scheme of things, this isn't a huge deal. The bigger problem for Turkey, as you mentioned, is the fact that the Trump administration approved plans to directly arm Kurdish fighters working in Syria with the U.S. military that are fighting against Islamic State. And Erdogan and Turkey view those fighters as an extension of the PKK, the Kurdish group in Turkey that is declared a terrorist group by the U.S. and Turkey. And President Erdogan actually didn't make a huge deal out of that. They wanted to get off on the right foot with the Trump administration and see if they could get things back on track after some pretty testy times with President Obama. So this incident will factor into that, and he is already using it as leverage. President Erdogan said soon after the charges were filed that he was going to fight it, and you know, why was he going to bring his bodyguards to Washington or America if they couldn't protect him?
Dion Nissenbaum, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Dion Nissenbaum is national security reporter for The Wall Street Journal.
People freak out when you say the word fat.
A few years back, the writer and activist Lindy West decided to reclaim the word fat.
I've been fat as long as I can remember, and at, you know, for most of my life, anytime I said the word fat, everyone like falls on the ground and starts crying and says you're not fat, which is like a weird lie. And it always all that ever did for me was make me feel like there was something wrong with me that we had to concoct an elaborate cover up.
Lindy West isn't just reclaiming a word. She's also leading a movement. She wants to change how we treat fat people, and she says that reclaiming that word is one way of standing up for herself. A few nights ago, Lindy West led a conversation in the green space here at WNYC to top off the Takeaways series of conversations exploring obesity in America. She was joined by Ashley Nell Tipton, the winner of Project Runway Season 14, and by Tamika Anderson, a writer and communications consultant. Ashley won Project Runway designing plus size clothing, and Tamika recently wrote an article in Ebony Magazine about black women and body image. That word, fat, was used a lot at the event. Lindy asked Tamika how she felt about it.
Any word that can be hurled at you like an epithet to me is not something that I really respond to. I like the word curvy. I like the word bodilicious. It really is about what you believe about yourself, and I believe myself not to be fat.
Do you feel like you move through the world and are seen as a fat person?
Well, I'm wearing a size 12. So, like, I think in the spectrum of things, a lot of people might consider me to be average size.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I have run the spectrum in terms of my sizes. I've been a size 10. I've been a size 24. Really, it has been what I most feel is representative of me. I don't really spend, especially at this age, I don't want to spend a whole lot of time thinking about what other people think of me.
Yeah, I understand that. How about you? I mean, I find it very liberating to get to move away from euphemisms and also move away from kind of clinical pathologizing terms like obesity and, I don't know, whatever else they like to call us.
I don't think anybody should use the word obese unless you are, and it's, you're talking about something, you're talking about your health. No one should go and call you or tell you you are obese. Like, that's none of your business, and just worry about your health, and I'm going to worry about my health.
So you recently decided to have weight loss surgery.
Yes.
Which is a really sort of controversial idea in the fat community.
Yes.
You want to talk a little bit about that?
Of course. I chose to get gastric bypass surgery because it was my decision. It was my health that was at risk. It became a problem where I had high blood pressure and I had a fatty liver, and I couldn't get up and climb the stairs. I was having a hard time walking. My back would hurt. My knees would hurt. It had nothing to do with how people were looking at me. It was how I felt in the inside. And I felt like I was trapped in my own body. And that's why I made the decision that I did.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, most of my job is trying to convince people that it's okay to have the body that you have. I'm not interested in putting more restrictions on what women can and can't do with their bodies.
Exactly.
I don't know, I just think it's important to acknowledge the diversity in people's experiences.
And not judge them for what they're doing. Because
I mean,
all I've heard is the negativity of this plus size community shaming me for what I've done. I didn't do this to break their hearts or make them feel worse than
that
they already are.
That would be so weird if you did.
Yeah, right? I mean, I did this because I want to be here.
All right, maybe we should talk about, can you ever trust people? Can you ever trust people who have never been considered fat to get your stories right? I think no.
I mean,
but you give them
can you relate
material.
To being black? Do you know what it is to be black?
No.
Exactly.
It's absolutely
the same,
not.
It's the same thing. Like, if you've never walked a mile in somebody's Spanx, you have no idea. But create space for that conversation.
Exactly. Do you ever feel like people show you who they are in a way that is disappointing?
Yes. I think being on Project Runway was a perfect example of seeing how people treat you because of your size. And I mean, if anyone had watched the show here, it was already the first episode and I had won a challenge. And by the third or fourth episode, I had already had two wins under my belt and there was a team challenge. And I was literally the last person chosen to be on a team. And Heidi Klum even gets on stage and was like, you guys didn't choose the person who has two wins under her belt. like, what is wrong with you guys? Because literally, I was the only fat person on that show. And I completely felt it. I remembered crying to myself in the bathroom, like, something's wrong with me. And it wasn't that. It was the people near me had a problem with my weight. If you know, personally know me, I'm not a very independent person. So for me to go on a reality show, not know anyone, to me it was like fighting for my life and defending my size and defending who I am and letting people know that I deserve to be here and deserve to live, deserve to be a creative person, to design fashion. Like, nobody should tell me anything else.
I mean, I think also part of that, yes.
Thank you.
You know, there's the regular standard popularity contest angle, and there's also the fact that we conflate fatness with laziness and with intellectual inferiority and mediocrity and incompetence. And, you know, it's really telling that despite clear evidence that you were talented, people still didn't take you seriously. I want to ask you about parenting. You know, sometimes people come to my events and they ask me, like, you know, my son's pediatrician says that he needs to lose weight, but I don't want to start him off with this lifetime of feeling like there's something wrong with him and like he's broken. What do I do? How do you think people should navigate that line?
You know, it's funny because my son has a completely different structure than me. He's super tall and lean. And so we'll see if that becomes, you know, any talking point for us. But that self-esteem piece, regardless of size, is really important to install early on.
Because they're just going to grow up with that mindset that something's wrong with them. Like, I've been big all my life, and I'm my mom's last child. And all my life, she's always told me to lose weight. I remember when I was 16 years old, she bought me a Nutrisystem for my birthday. Like, if it was something that I asked for. So it's just like, I don't see her very often now, and we still live in the same city, but I'm close to her. We talk every day. But she sees me in person, she's like, oh, mija, you're so beautiful. And I'm like, Mom, I've always been beautiful. I don't know what you've been seeing, but I've been beautiful all this time.
That's Ashley Nell Tipton, the winner of Project Runway Season 14, and writer and communications consultant Tamika Anderson in conversation with writer and activist and the evening's moderator, Lindy West. And we leave you today with a moment of unity from last night on the baseball diamond.
I think these people that want to destroy our lives, our livelihood here in America, they win if we give in. America doesn't give out. America doesn't give in. And we must play this baseball game. If we don't play this baseball game and we go home, then they win.
And play they did in front of a record crowd in Washington, D.C. That's Congressman Roger Williams of Texas talking about the annual congressional baseball game between Democrats and Republicans last night. It took on a very different and non-competitive tone following Wednesday's shooting on a GOP practice field that left Congressman Steve Scalise, the whip, in hospital battling serious injuries. Democrats took the trophy but gave it to Representative Scalise after the game. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, with a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving, training programs that draw from 50 brain games, and tools to compare scores with global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com. By Staples. Staples offers copy and print services for businesses, including color copies, presentations, and promotional products. More at Staples stores or at staples.com. Staples, it's pro time. TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA believes smart financial decisions should enable life, not define it. TIAA calls this the new success story. Learn more at TIAA.org. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.